Well, thank you all for coming to this session after lunch. I know that's always a bit of a slow period for people, but I've been delighted to be asked to speak about the issue of HIV criminalization, which is something that I and my organization have been working on for a number of years. I work with, as you heard, the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. It's a human rights research, education, and advocacy NGO based in Toronto. We work across Canada, but also extensively internationally in a number of regions and at the United Nations. And what I wanted to do today was the following. I wanted to give you, first of all, an overview of the legal landscape when it comes to HIV criminalization. Look at a number of the arguments that are advanced for HIV criminalization and actually assess the strength of those arguments in accord with their own logic and on their own terms. Identify for you a number of the harms of overly broad HIV criminalization, which is a growing problem. And then turn a little bit to what is being done and what can be done about responding to what is a public health challenge and a human rights challenge in the misuse and over-application of the criminal law. And at the end, I'll have some thoughts about how we go about tackling this. But first, let's define what we're talking about. This is a definition that a new global coalition called HIV Justice Worldwide uses to unpack what the short-term phrase HIV criminalization means. It's specifically the unjust application of the criminal law to people living with HIV based on their HIV status. And that can take the form of either the legislating and enforcement of HIV-specific criminal statutes that single out HIV, sometimes other sexually transmitted infections as well, or by applying general criminal code or penal code offenses exclusively or disproportionately against people living with HIV. And we'll come back to how that manifests in a number of places. So what is the legal landscape? I want to just give you the briefest overview of the global picture and the history of how HIV criminalization has evolved as a global phenomenon and problem for human rights and public health. Things began here in the U.S., followed soon after in Canada, when we began to see the first HIV-specific criminal statutes being enacted in the mid to late 1980s. And although we don't have an HIV-specific criminal statute in Canada, as I'll discuss in a moment, we also began to see the first prosecutions in Canada. And it certainly remains the case that the U.S. and Canada are by far the world leaders in the use of criminal law against people living with HIV. In the early 1990s, the Ryan White Care Act further boosted the spread of HIV criminalization in the U.S. by basically attaching strings to federal dollars that would be available to states, requiring them to have some sort of mechanism that would allow the application of criminal law against people living with HIV. And by this point, we began to see some of the first prosecutions in Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. But what we didn't see in those jurisdictions was any major push in most of that area for HIV-specific laws, unlike in the U.S. Things really started to take off in the late 1990s and early 2000s on a global level, and we began to see significant and growing interest around the world in the potential use of HIV criminal law, or criminal law against people living with HIV. And one of the ways in which this really took shape was the push for omnibus AIDS laws or HIV laws in a number of countries that usually ended up including some sort of provision criminalizing people living with HIV under various circumstances. And we have seen that the prevalence of HIV criminalization continues to increase. So at the moment, at least 72 countries have HIV-specific laws. Now, if you include individual U.S. states, because, of course, criminal law in the U.S. operates along state lines as well as some federal law, we're actually up to 101 jurisdictions that have HIV-specific criminal laws. That includes 30 countries in Africa, and most of those are of relatively recent vintage, so within the last 10 to 15 years. We have at least 61 countries where we know there have been HIV-related prosecutions. Again, if we include U.S. states and Australian states and territories who also have criminal law at the state and territorial level, we're up to 105 jurisdictions. And you see the breakdown there of how the countries that have actually used the criminal law against people living with HIV have done so, in what mechanism or through what form. And just in the last 2.5 years, research done tracking and monitoring these developments around the world as best we can, the HIV Justice Network and GMP Plus have found at least 313 proceedings in 28 countries, but that is certainly underreporting, there's no question. So a couple of visuals to give you a sense of where HIV criminalization is happening and in what form. I apologize that if the formatting for this, it might be a little small for you to see at the back of the room. But these are the countries where, as of a few months ago, there are HIV-specific criminal laws, or jurisdictions, I should say. These are the countries where prosecutions have ever taken place. So both, whether it's under an HIV-specific criminal law or under the application of general criminal laws. So obviously a much broader range of countries. This is a snapshot of the last 30 months where prosecutions have taken place during that time that we're aware of. And again, this is underreporting. And the intensity of the color gives you a sense of just how robustly the criminal law is being applied against people living with HIV. But it's also a mixed picture in that in some jurisdictions there has been pushback by activists, and in some cases proposals for new HIV-specific laws have been defeated, and in some cases have actually been repealed or significantly amended to actually limit their scope. So, you know, it's not all just an ever-growing picture of gloom and doom. There are some bright spots. In the U.S., there are at least 33 states and 2 territories that have some HIV-specific law, but there's quite a lot of variability from jurisdiction to jurisdiction in terms of how widely or narrowly crafted the law is as to the conduct that it captures, what degree of what we call in law mens rea or mental culpability is required to establish a conviction. For example, does there actually have to be intent to transmit, or is it a lower standard of something like recklessness? And some provide certain defenses, affirmative defenses to possible liability, such as condom use, for example, or disclosure. Even in those jurisdictions where there is some HIV-specific law, that doesn't necessarily oust the ability of prosecutors to use general criminal offenses that may also be available, and that has been done in a number of cases. Another dimension of HIV criminalization, and this is something that is actually quite common in a number of U.S. states, is to actually enhance penalties against accused people who are HIV positive in the course of committing other offenses, and in particular offenses related to prostitution, solicitation, and so on. So engaging in those criminalized offenses while HIV positive carries an extra burden. And there are at least 660 prosecutions to date in the U.S., but this is absolutely an underreporting of the actual true figure. There's no question. Now, Canada's a slightly different picture because, as I said, we don't have HIV-specific law. We also have one criminal law for the whole country. It's at the federal level, although it is administered at the provincial and territorial level. We don't have separate provincial criminal law. And there is no HIV-specific provision in our federal criminal code. In fact, there used to be a provision related to spreading venereal disease, but it was repealed in the mid-1980s. And although there have been proposals a couple of times to actually reintroduce some variation of that in our criminal code, they have not succeeded. So the way that HIV criminalization has manifested and evolved has been through the application by prosecutors and judges of other provisions in the criminal code, applying them to new circumstances of HIV risk or HIV transmission. And some of the offenses that have been used to prosecute people, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, are listed here. And I want to focus in on the last one of these, the offense of aggravated sexual assault, because that is actually the one that is most significant and is most frequently used now. And in particular, a couple of decisions from our Supreme Court, one going back to the late 90s and one just a couple of years ago, have actually confirmed and somewhat clarified the scope of HIV criminalization under our sexual assault provisions. So our provisions on sexual assault a number of years ago replaced a narrower provision on rape. So it's a broader, more broadly defined offense of sexual assault. And basically it's any assault, so physical contact, in sexual circumstances. And one of the ways in which consent to that sexual contact can be vitiated or rendered legally invalid is if that consent has been obtained through fraud. And so the question before our courts that is now largely settled is whether not disclosing the fact you have HIV or potentially another sexually transmitted infection amounts to a fraud in law that would turn that otherwise consensual sexual encounter into a sexual assault. And what are those circumstances in which that would happen? The Supreme Court, in the first case to consider this question, turned to a question of harm or risk of harm as really the controlling concept in determining when the criminal law should be triggered, and they set the threshold of there having to be some sort of significant risk of serious bodily harm as the point beyond which the duty to disclose would be triggered, and if you didn't, you could potentially be prosecuted and convicted for sexual assault. The prosecution also has to prove, although this is often very easily done and there isn't much scrutiny of this, that the person who is complaining of being sexually assaulted would not have consented to the sex had they known the person's HIV status. So there has to be some causal connection between the person not disclosing and the consent being obtained in order for that fraud to be made out. And the basic offense then becomes an aggravated offense of sexual assault if it endangers the life of the complainant, and the courts, without a lot of consideration since, certainly pronounced in this early case that the risk of acquiring HIV would endanger someone's life, and therefore it becomes an aggravated sexual assault. Now, this is one of the most serious offenses in our criminal code, carrying a maximum penalty of life in prison and presumptive lifetime designation as a sex offender. So you see that the way the law of sexual assault has been applied, we have effectively equated HIV nondisclosure in some circumstances to a particularly violent rape. So beyond the violence that is inherent in rape, but something that is particularly egregious, if one can say that. More recently, the Supreme Court revisited this question and actually made things worse, in my submission, and reinterpreted specifically in the HIV context that a significant risk of serious bodily harm means there is some realistic possibility of transmission. So this is the key phrase now. And so many of us who were intervening in front of the court in that case made a number of submissions about how this significant risk concept should be understood, and certainly tried to say that at least in a number of circumstances, such as people using condoms or having an undetectable viral load, for example, there should be the law should not treat that as carrying a significant risk of transmission for purposes of criminally prosecuting people. And therefore, there's no duty to disclose if either of those things is present. We also made a submission that oral sex does not carry a significant enough risk of transmission to trigger criminal prosecution. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court, notwithstanding the science in front of it from the HPTN 052 trial, among other things, was not willing to accept that submission and said, at least with respect to vaginal sex, the only clear circumstance in which we as the court are prepared to say there's no duty to disclose is if you have both a low viral load, note that they said low, not undetectable, and the evidence in front of them referred to 1,500 copies per milliliter, and a condom, so what some people have referred to as a belt and suspenders approach. A number of questions remain, of course. What is a low viral load? As I said, 1,500 is probably what the court had in mind, since they refer to a study in which that was the figure being used. What about anal sex? They didn't address that because of the facts of the case, did not raise it. There is a possibility that given there's a higher risk of transmission, that perhaps even if you use a condom and you have a low viral load, that would not be considered in the court's mind sufficiently low risk enough, although I think probably they won't draw that fine a distinction. And what about oral sex? The court was silent on it. And a question that we thought was settled, unfortunately, in a bad way, may not be quite so settled as we thought, because as you recall, we submitted that either a condom or an undetectable or low viral load should suffice to relieve you of the duty to disclose. The court didn't buy it then. However, there have been a number of subsequent lower court judgments that have had real issues with how far the Supreme Court went and have been clear on the record about that and actually said, no, we are going to apply the test of a realistic possibility of transmission quite stringently. And given the evidence in front of us from a medical expert, and these mostly had to do with undetectable viral load, we actually don't find, as a matter of fact, that there was a realistic possibility of transmission with this HIV positive accused who had an undetectable viral load, and so they have acquitted. So the door that we thought was shut may be open a crack, so we'll see where that goes. Now, we've seen at least 181 people charged so far. Most of the cases have been against men who have sex with women. although there have been an increasing number of gay men and other MSM prosecuted and of women. And if you look at the women who have been prosecuted, it's not surprising that they are disproportionately indigenous women and or marginalized in other ways. And it also appears that black men in particular have been disproportionately prosecuted, and certainly in the media coverage of cases that has often been quite sensational, they are disproportionately represented in the media coverage. Note that although this is a general criminal code offense, and in theory it applies to any sexually transmitted infection that poses a risk of serious bodily harm, almost all of the prosecutions have been for HIV. There are 5 or 6 non-HIV prosecutions for herpes and hep C. I'll skip over the stats about race and ethnicity, but basically black men are disproportionately criminalized in Canada. So turning then for a moment to whether we should be applying the criminal law in this way and how far we might legitimately, on the terms of the criminal law's own logic, apply the criminal law, we should think for a moment about what the criminal law says it's actually setting out to do. And there are 4 basic functions of the criminal law. The first is to incapacitate people, the second is to rehabilitate people, the third is to deter people, and the fourth is to impose retribution. The first 3, we could say, perhaps serve some sort of public health objective. And I think it's important to acknowledge that fact, at least theoretically, because in our Supreme Court's jurisprudence, they very much took the line that using the criminal law would serve a public health function, and it would be a supplement to public health interventions, including through its deterrent impact. But I think we need to interrogate that a little bit, and I submit that when we look at each of those rationales for criminalization more carefully, we actually don't see more than a very limited justification for the application of the criminal law. The first is, when we restrict people's liberty, so we incapacitate them from causing further harm, we do sort of, but not really, because people are generally incarcerated for a certain period of time or otherwise subject to restrictions of liberty. We know that risks of transmission and acquisition of infection in prison are often higher for a host of reasons, and we know that the health of prisoners is actually community health since most people leave prison. So we're not actually necessarily helping public health all that much through this particular function of the criminal law, or at least it's quite qualified. Rehabilitation, does anyone seriously think that the criminal law serves any particularly rehabilitative function? I think it's a fiction that the system likes to maintain, but I don't know that we see any particular evidence that the criminal law does that, particularly when it overreaches and criminalizes conduct that for many people they do not see as particularly problematic and that may not be that divergent from community norms about disclosure, non-disclosure, etc. Deterrence. This is the big one that is claimed for the criminal law. Now, in theory, the possibility of a penalty would cause people to either disclose to a partner or not engage in certain prohibited activity that poses certain kinds of risks. But we actually don't have a lot of evidence to suggest that the criminal law has a particularly deterrent function in this realm. And, of course, it requires, if it's going to have any impact at all, that people know that they have HIV. So right there, there's a public health issue that should be flagged for us, because knowing your status then exposes you to possible criminal prosecution. You also have to know what conduct is legally prohibited, which some studies, including those in the U.S., show most people don't really have a good sense of that. You also have to accord some degree of weight to the prospect that you might be prosecuted and convicted. If all of those things obtain, you might have some deterrent effect of the criminal law, but I think we have to heavily qualify it. And so what I think this is really about ultimately is retribution. It's about punishing people for the sake of punishing them because we don't like the conduct. And largely what this is doing is we're harnessing the power of the state to actually displace the responsibility on people who are or believe themselves to be HIV negative for preventing the transmission of HIV solely to people who are HIV positive. We are so unwilling to actually take responsibility that we say we must harness the power of the state through its criminal law power to actually ostensibly compel people to disclose to us so that we don't have to worry about it. And if they don't disclose to us because the law says they must, therefore there isn't any issue. Again, we can only justify imposing punishment for the sake of punishment in some narrow set of cases. So I think there's a limited argument on criminal law's own terms for anything more than a fairly limited application of the criminal law. There's a slew of harms that it causes in terms of creating a false sense of security, as I just referred to, and you see this over and over and over again in the testimony of complainants in proceedings who say, well, you know, I wouldn't have had sex with him if he told me that he was HIV positive. He should have told me. And the 25% of people with HIV in Canada who don't actually know that fact, what do you do about that? And the abdication of responsibility that is inherent in that statement, I think, is problematic, including from a public health perspective. It spreads misinformation about HIV, especially when we get bad media coverage, and a number of other harms that follow, including potentially creating a disincentive to testing, interrupting relationships between service providers and patients, discriminatory application of the law, and so on. This is what part of the face of HIV criminalization looks like, including in the US. Someone spending 30 years in a prison who had an undetectable viral load and used a condom and didn't transmit HIV, but is in jail for 30 years. That's what HIV criminalization looks like. I just want to flag a couple of things that now need to happen in my 1 minute, if the moderator will indulge me. I think the same way we talk about combination prevention, we need to talk about combination resistance to unjust HIV criminalization. And what that means is we need a number of proposals for legislative reforms and changing legal interpretations by the court. We need to educate justice system actors. We need guidelines for prosecutors and police. And the way we get there is through these things. We have to know what the law is and how to influence it. We have to know the science, because the science has played a key role in the formulation of the criminal law. And I skipped over a bunch of slides outlining an emerging international scientific consensus about the importance of limiting the criminal law, because it's actually increasingly diverging from the science we have about HIV risk, and we need the voices of people most affected in this struggle. So let me leave it there, and I would be happy to take any questions, and I thank you for the extra minute of time.